So tonight I'm just going to talk a little bit about, in the first half of the class, about the parable of the raft, which is a very old story from the early Buddhist scriptures. And as well as, it is one of the chapters in this book, Crossing the Stream, which forms our theme for this city retreat. But unlike Bodhilila and Yashobodhi yesterday, I'm not really going to refer very much to the essay itself, but I'm instead going to go back to the actual story of the parable of the raft, because I think it's quite a lovely story and there is a lot in it. So we're going to just explore the story itself, so to speak, and we'll hear the whole story as part of the talk as well. So you can see on this shrine, some of you have been looking at it a lot, I've been building a little stream in a raft just to so that you've got a visual image of it. So one of the images for the Buddhist path and for what we're trying to do, transforming our minds and changing our minds, one of the images that the Buddha used when he was describing that process was crossing the stream from one bank to the other bank. And his idea in that was that the hither shore, as he called it in very ancient language, so the shore that we're usually on, sort of in our mundane lives, when we haven't worked on developing our minds yet, is the shore of samsara. So it's the kind of world where things happen, we react to them, we get angry, we react to each other, we get into conflict, we get into a mess. We compete against each other, etc. We live in a state of mind where we are the center of the universe. We try and get the best out of life for ourselves, experience quite often others as obstacles, don't really think about the consequences of what we're doing. So at worst, it's that kind of state where we're just not reflective, we're just not thinking, and things obviously go wrong when you're in that state of mind. And then the further shore, the shore that we want to get to with Buddhist practice, is kind of a world where we look at things in a different way. So on this hither shore, just to come back briefly to that, a lot of our actions and what we say and even what we think springs from greed, hatred and delusion. There is another Buddhist image of the wheel of life, where there are three animals in the middle of the wheel of life that are biting each other's tails. It's a cock, a snake and a pig. And those three little animals stand for greed, hatred and delusion. And we're often driven by those emotions unless we work on ourselves and make sure that we transform our minds so that we're no longer so driven by those emotions. So on the further shore, the hope is that we have developed our minds enough so that instead we're our actions and our speech, what we say and what we think, is informed by wisdom and compassion. By seeing things clearly and seeing them from the widest possible perspective, and by bringing love and compassion to whatever we're doing, to every situation that we're facing. And that's love and compassion, just like in the Metta Bhavana, for ourselves as well as for others, as well as for all that lives. So that is what we're crossing over from and to, in a way, in that image. And the Buddha and his followers, they lived quite a nomadic life in India 2,500 years or so ago. They spent most of their time outdoors in nature, so it was a very different life from our city-based modern lives now, or postmodern lives. And it's for that reason, I think, that the Buddha often used quite evocative nature-based images to elucidate his teachings. So boats and rafts and streams would have been quite an ordinary part of his listeners' experience, which they could easily relate to and understand. So he used images from people's everyday lives. And when I first heard the story, I suppose I'm not really a city person, so I grew up by quite a big lake in southern Germany. And at the moment, actually, I live by the river near Chiswick and Hammersmith. So I really can also relate from my personal experience to the image of a stream and a river and the effect that has, you know, being on one shore and wondering what's on the other shore, etc. So there is something very evocative for me personally in that image, which is why I chose that theme for my talk tonight. I've completely fallen in love with the river, actually. It's very, very powerful, even a river in the middle of the city, you know, just the flowing of it. We have had some quite difficult experiences over the year in our community from the point of view of sort of dynamics and trying to come together, etc. But I think all of us, you know, you just look at that river and you look at it just flowing through everything, whatever happens, and it sort of brings things literally back in perspective. And then there's the sky reflected in the river. It opens up a sense of spaciousness. The air is clearer. It's quite incredible what an effect that river has. And I've never even been very aware of it before, you know, but being near it, it's just so clear. So I want us to hear the story first, the actual parable of the raft in its old language, and then I'll unpack a few of the themes that are in the story. So maybe, Charlotte, have you got a story there, if you could read it? Have you got enough light to see it, though?
Yes,
yeah.
I'm
okay.
I shall show you, monks, the teaching's similitude to a raft, as having the purpose of crossing over, not the purpose of being clung to. Listen, monks, and heed well what I shall say. Yes, Lord, replied the monks, and the Blessed One spoke thus. Suppose, monks, there is a man journeying on a road, and he sees a vast expanse of water, of which this shore is perilous and fearful, while the other shore is safe and free from danger. But there is no boat for crossing, nor is there a bridge for going over from this side to the other. So the man thinks, this is a vast expanse of water, and this shore is perilous and fearful, but the other shore is safe and free from danger. There is, however, no boat here for crossing, nor a bridge for going over from this side to the other. Suppose I gather reeds, sticks, branches, and foliage, and bind them into a raft. Now that man collects reeds, sticks, branches, and foliage, and binds them into a raft. Carried by that raft, labouring with hands and feet, he safely crosses over to the other shore. Having crossed and arrived at the other shore, he thinks, this raft indeed has been very helpful to me. Carried by it, labouring with hands and feet, I got safely across to the other shore. Should I not lift this raft on my head or put it on my shoulders and go where I like? What do you think about it, O monks? Will this man, by acting thus, do what should be done with a raft? No, Lord. How then, monks, would he be doing what ought to be done with a raft? Here, monks, having got across and arrived at the other shore, the man thinks, this raft, indeed, has been very helpful to me. Carried by it and labouring with hands and feet, I got safely across to the other shore. Should I not pull it up now to the dry land, or let it float in the water and then go as I please? By acting thus, monks, would that man do what should be done with a raft? In the same way, monks, have I shown to you the teaching's similitude to a raft, as having the purpose of crossing over, not the purpose of being clung to. You, O monks, who understand the teaching's similitude to a raft, you should let go even good teachings, how much more false ones.
So as you can hear from that story, you know, as well as giving you a simile for what happens when we transform our minds, crossing from the hither shore to the further shore, it also gives you another main teaching, which is that once you've made use of the teachings and once you have reached that other shore, you know, once you have made use of the raft and there you are, don't cling to it, don't hang on to it, let go of it, you know. You've now used it, you don't need it any longer, you can leave it behind, somebody else might be able to make use of it, rather than clinging to things. So very, very important further teaching there as well. I think both teachings are important. You know, we are probably all in a state still where we very much need the Buddhist teachings. And you could sort of think of the reeds or the sticks that the raft is made out of as the different Buddhist teachings that kind of hang together in a coherent shape. They do hang together in quite a coherent shape. The basic Buddhist teachings, they're kind of full of lists of things and quite practical methods of this is what you can do to develop your mind. There's all the meditation instructions and there's other teachings. The main teaching that I was thinking of when I was thinking of the raft is the Eightfold Path. So you could think of a raft made of eight sticks maybe, and it's the Eightfold Path. So what I'm going to do is just take you through, in a way, the eight folds of the Eightfold Path, which is the main teaching, and just say a few things about each one. And as you listen to it, see if you can relate what's being said, what I'm saying, to your own life. You know, thinking, is there something in each of those sections that I'll be talking about that you feel, oh yes, I should really let go of that, and you know, I could that would help me, or oh, I really need this at the moment. This particular quality or this particular thing should be the next thing I should really focus on. So think about it from both points of view. You know, what in your life at the moment should you let go of in order to make things a bit easier? And what do you really need to hold on to in order to help you cross that stream? Does that make sense? So if you listen to it from that point of view. So in the Eightfold Path, the first step is perfect vision, what's called perfect vision or right view sometimes. And that's quite essential in getting us started and to have the necessary motivation even to start on the Buddhist path, to learn to meditate, for example, or to stick with something like coming to a centre like this. Not everybody has enough motivation or enough urgency to actually find a path and follow it and transform their minds. You need to, first of all, something that really grabs you, so to speak, something that really, really motivates you and inspires you. So this could be a glimpse of something beyond ordinary mundane life. It could be a glimpse of beauty. You could get it in nature, you could get it from art, something that just gives you an experience of, oh, there's more to life than just everyday mundane experience. There's more, and which makes you want to look for more. Could be music, I don't know, some of you might be able to think of an experience where you've just felt a bit transported out of your ordinary experience when you were maybe looking at a painting or heard a piece of music or even were in a beautiful natural place and it was just like you were in another world. So that kind of experience. It could also be extreme pain, actually. So it could be the opposite. You know, you might have lost somebody very close to you. You might have been very ill and thought you might die. So it could be quite an extreme experience like that that shocks you into thinking, goodness, life is really not kind of safe, you know, it's not going to last forever. That makes you very, very aware that there is suffering in life, that you lose people, that you eventually will even lose your life. So that kind of experience too can give you that kind of first glimpse of, oh my goodness, I must try and make sense of what life is actually about, and gets you onto the spiritual path. So then the second part of the Eightfold Path, the second fold, so to speak, is perfect emotion. And Sangharakshita, the founder of this Buddhist movement and order, said at one point that for most of us, the central problem of the spiritual life is to find emotional equivalence for our intellectual understanding. So it's not just enough just to rationally know and understand something, But our emotional energies, which are much stronger than our rational minds, really, they also have to be involved. So we need to try and get all of our energies behind things, not just understanding and wanting something with our rational minds, but also really getting our emotional energy behind it. So we need to kind of find out, once we've decided that maybe the Buddhist path could be it for us, you know, what exactly is it that inspires us? So it might be a particular aspect of the Buddha's life. It might be a particular teaching that really speaks to us. It might be something about being with others, practicing like here, that really thinks, yes, that inspires me. It could be a particular meditation practice. It's quite important to find what is it that you really love and that you can emotionally relate to. Could also be a mythical Buddha figure. I don't know if some of you might have come across those. A particular quality of the Buddha that can sometimes be personified in those mythical figures. So that might be worth thinking about. What is that for you at the moment? Could be a teacher, an inspiring teacher that you've read or that you've met. I mean, just to give you one example from my life, I do the meditation practice now that I'm ordained into this order, visualizing a figure called Padmasambhava. So for me, Padmasambhava is really my inspiration. It's almost like he is my teacher, although he's not obviously a living person. He's this mythical figure. He was a historical figure. But there's something about his energy of just taking everything onto the path and transforming negative states, which has been quite a lot of... it's quite important for me. It has been very important for me and still is. That's really speaks to me. And when I lose inspiration, I just need to bring Padmasambhava to mind, and that will get me re-inspired. So perfect emotion is the second fold of the Eightfold Path. And then the third fold is perfect speech. So it's working on our speech, on what we say. And there is another old text where the Buddha gives his monks advice on speech. And I just thought it's worth reading that out to you, because it's very, very interesting what the Buddha said about speech. So he said to his monks, he said, if it is false, unhelpful and unpleasant, don't say it. If it is true, unhelpful and unpleasant, don't say it. If it's true, helpful and unpleasant, choose the right time. If it is false, unhelpful and pleasant, don't say it. If it is true, unhelpful and pleasant, don't say it. If it is true, helpful and pleasant, choose the right time. So I think that's brilliant, isn't it? Because it just shows, goodness, you know what? How much useless talking we do, how much inauthentic talking we do. And actually it makes you really think, what really needs to be said, you know, and what shouldn't be said. And also the value of silence, of just not saying anything sometimes. So I've got that up in my room, because I think it's worth remembering that. So perfect speech. Then there is perfect action, the fourth fold. So there is something quite particular about the Buddhist ethical principles. They're not like in other religions, kind of commandments or rules that you have to follow and you should follow. They're more like training principles. So you really, what Buddhism, what the Buddha is trying to teach us, is to take responsibility, to take full responsibility for our actions and for ourselves and for our states of mind. So it's not that some actions are bad and some actions are good. It's more like what really matters is the state of mind out of which you act. So an action is skillful when it springs from love, from generosity, from wisdom, from seeing things clearly, and an action is unskillful when it springs from greed, hatred and delusion, basically. So it's not so much the action itself, it's the state of mind that really, really matters. And in a way, you know, whether an action is skillful or unskillful, it might look very unskillful. Let's say you can get somebody shouting at somebody, But then you don't know the context. You know, that person might be shouting because they're actually alerting somebody urgently to some danger or something. So it really, Buddhism also teaches us not to assume, just to sort of look at the full context. And the most important thing about action is, I suppose, not to resort to violence. So the first precept in Buddhism is not to do harm to other living beings, or not to do harm to living beings, including yourself. So that is always the one that should be foremost in your mind, and all the others follow from that. And then the fifth fold is perfect livelihood. So it's quite interesting, it's quite a specific one. It's quite interesting that the Buddha focused on that. I suppose it's when he was teaching lay people, you know, he was teaching lay people as well as monks who followed him. And what he was saying is that you should try, if you do follow the Buddhist path, to have an occupation that doesn't harm life. So like we've just said, not harming life is the most important thing. And which is in contradiction to the other precepts, but particularly occupations that don't harm life. So in this Buddhist community, in the Triratna community, Sangharakshita, when he first founded it, he had quite an emphasis on people looking at that, you know, looking at their lifestyle. Although your lifestyle isn't of primary importance, you know, primary importance is that you have a belief in the path and in the Buddha, and you follow the teachings. But it is important, and it can make quite a difference if you, for example, work with other like-minded people, if you live communally, if you have conditions that help you practice. So say if you live with other people who meditate, then that helps you, because they will they will help you get motivated to get up in the morning and meditate. If you work with other Buddhists, then you can encourage each other not to do harm and to be ethical about what you do. So there's quite an emphasis on kind of exemplifying a way of living which might be quite different from the mainstream way of living. And I think it's quite an interesting area that we maybe need to revisit in our times. You know, there used to be, when the order was first founded, quite a lot of right livelihood businesses where people would work together as Buddhists and work and not earn very much money, but to sort of live community and work together. It's more difficult to do today, so I think it's something that we need to revisit a little bit and look at. But even if you don't live communally and work in a right livelihood business, you can look at, well, what is your work? Is it ethical? Is it not harming life? And also, what can you do with your money? What can you usefully do with your money is a good question to ask yourself. So, I mean, in my own life, I've sort of gone, it's quite interesting. I used to be a teacher. I used to be a primary teacher, which was, you know, it's quite good work. I've moved from that to being a child psychotherapist. And I'm at the moment, I still work as a child psychotherapist, but I used to work full time, and it took all my time and energy. And I didn't actually have very much time to meditate or to teach, or, you know, I was just exhausted at the end of the day. So I've moved from that to working part time. So that might think, well, I'm doing less than I could do, you know, for the children that I see therapeutically. But I found, well, what it gives me is time and energy to do things like this, you know, to teach, to meditate, to teach in Buddhist centers. And there's not many people who do that, you know. One of my Buddhist teachers once told me that there are lots of therapists around. There's not so many Dharma teachers. And it's true, I suppose. And you know, I think, and I do now really believe that these teachings and these practices, the meditation practices, are very important, you know, so it's important to share them. So if you can share them, that's also important work. Yes, so that's perfect livelihood. Then there's perfect effort, which I'm just going to briefly mention, but that's one that can be gone into quite a lot. So perfect effort just means that at all times, it's a bit to do with mindfulness really, that at all times and in any situation, what we should try to do, the Buddha taught, is we should prevent and eradicate negative mental states, and we should develop and maintain positive mental states whenever possible. So it's about creating the internal conditions in our own minds and creating external conditions that are conducive to that, you know, so that we can be in a positive state of mind, stay in it, not get into a negative mental state and not act from a negative mental state. So always looking out for doing that. So really that pertains to all situations we're in, very important. Then there's perfect mindfulness, so being aware of ourselves. So that's what we sort of learn in the mindfulness of breathing. So aware of our body, of our thoughts, of our feelings, of other people, of other living beings, and aware of reality, again, from the widest possible perspective. So more and more trying to see things as they really are and seeing them not only from our very narrow, what can I get out of it, point of view, but seeing them more as to what can I give to this situation. Very different state of mind if you can ask yourself, okay, what's needed here? What can I offer? As when you say, okay, what can I grab here? What can I get for myself? Two opposite states of mind. And then finally, there's perfect meditation or samadhi. So that is really, I suppose that is when you reach the further shore, so to speak. You would be in a state of mind where you're practicing all of those things that I've just been talking about, and you've got quite far in your practice. So as a result, you can really look at reality as it is. You can see that things are impermanent, you can see that things are insubstantial. When you're in pain or when something difficult happens, you can have a measure of equanimity about that and not get too blown about by it or too upset by it. If something good happens to you, you don't get too overexcited about it. So you're in a kind of balanced state of mind, a balanced enough state of mind, so that when you meditate, you really can meditate, not just trying to calm your mind down and keep your body still, but actually that just happens naturally, and you can begin to then gain insight and see things much more clearly and also develop much more compassion. It's sort of, there is a point you reach, apparently, I certainly haven't reached it yet, where that happens more naturally, where you naturally want to just act compassionately and where you naturally just can see a situation from a very wide perspective. And the natural thing is just to go and help wherever help is needed. So in summary, it's just so, the parable of the raft, there's obviously a lot in it, and my one main message in it, I think, is also that it's the spirit of the Dharma that counts and not the dead letter. It's kind of methods and practices, all the methods and practices you learn here, for example, they're a means to an end. And the end is kind of enlightenment, liberation, release from suffering. They're not kind of, don't cling to them for the sake of them, or for status, or for whatever, you know, I can do the mindfulness of breathing. They're means to an end. They're a method. They're a method to a particular goal, and that's liberation. So you should hold on to and practice for as long as you need to, whatever is helpful to you in taking you forward in the direction of seeing things more clearly and developing more compassion. And you should let go of whatever you don't any longer need, because you're there now. So that is what the Buddha seems to be saying with this parable. And he said that even good and valid teachings and practices should be let go of when they become kind of, I think what he meant is when they become a bit stale or habitual. And I can certainly relate to that sometimes. You know, I just, meditation for me, for example, has become a bit like brushing my teeth, but sometimes I can just do it because I do it, you know, and I don't really think about it. It's not really meditation. I'll just sit there. I don't know what I've been doing for the past hour. So it's when you do sort of things mechanically like that, you have to look at them again and see if you can find a new way of inspiring yourself to actually do it meaningfully. And there is a favorite line in the Heart Sutra, which we'll recite later on, which says, holding to nothing whatever. So your aim should be to hold to nothing whatever, to just let go of everything, which is obviously very challenging, but also quite inspiring as an aim. And we can't, of course, make a sudden jump from sort of anxiously clinging and grasping to things and people, as we mostly do, and also sort of structures and habits that give us a kind of illusion that things are safe and we know what's happening. To begin with, and for quite a long time to come, and maybe even several lifetimes, we do need to a raft made of the teachings and practices we encounter, made out of friends as well, of places like this to come to, which feel safe, which feel conducive to our practice. And that's good, and that's right. We can't let go of things straight away all of a sudden. But there will come a point, if we carry on the path, when we realise we have maybe reached that great other shore of greater wisdom. And at that point, we can leave the raft of the teachings and attachments and entanglements behind, and, like the Buddha, walk kind of in complete freedom and live a life of spontaneous, compassionate activity. And in a way, it sounds very, very far away, but it is important to keep that goal in mind. So every time we salute the shrine, for example, what we're really saying is, here is the Buddha. He's done it. He's taken the raft to the other shore, and we can do it too. We can do it if we keep our momentum and if we keep going in the right direction. Okay, I think I'll leave it there.